Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sam Morse. Welcome to the Car Chat podcast. And with me today, I have Sandy Copeman. Hello.
Hi there, Sam.
Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Can you tell the audience a little bit about sort of who you are and what you do?
So I was one of the founder members of a model making company called Amalgam in 1985. And there's a story to be told there about how we eventually ended up making big scale model cars for Formula One teams and then ultimately for Ferrari and their ilk. And I'm now the brand marketing and business development director with Amalgam Collection.
So, okay. It didn't start off with cars, did it?
No, started off with architecture and product prototypes. And we had the four partners who founded Amalgam in the Amalgam model makers we were back then in 1985. We'd all been working with somebody else with a small Bristol-based general model making company. And we had some connections with Norman Foster and partners because we'd worked on some projects with this other company where we decided to go it alone and create Amalgam. And so we started straight into making models for Foster and Partners, and which kind of set the tone really for the way that we were going to go right the way through, continuing into the era of model cars, in that we always wanted to work with inspirational designers and, you know, the very best designers, companies, brands. And we did a bit of work with the other early days with Amalgam making product prototypes. We did a bit of work with James Dyson as well.
Oh, really?
And I remember having a horrendous session trying to cast one of the original, the clear plastic container, the bucket, as it were. I've forgotten what the rather fancy name that James Dyson had for that. But it was a nightmare job. But we got there in the end. So we started off, you know, as a small Bristol-based company, we started off pretty well with some pretty high, yet-to-be, you know, high-profile customers in case of Dyson. But with Foster's, that was a really fantastic start.
And before that point, so you all previously working for a separate company, had you been like, how did you even get into that? Were you making models at home and then was like, I want to do this as a job, or end up falling into it?
Yeah, that was a kind of a happy accident. But then, you know, happy accidents happen for a reason, usually, don't they? We're not being mystical about it or anything, but they happen because the opportunity is attractive in some way, you know, for both parties or whatever. And I had made models as a kid, you know, built kits like everybody. So there was nothing unusual about that, you know, models of the Scharnhorst, I remember, Airfix kit of the Scharnhorst or Spitfire and so forth. Which actually, in truth, I mangled terribly, so they weren't fine examples of model makers' art. And then something that probably was significant is I got into slot car racing when I was about 15, and I joined the local Lewisham because I was born and brought up in southeast London, And I joined the Lewisham Slot Car Racing Club, which had a big events room that was laid out with a handmade circuit above a pub,
yeah,
which is typical of those kind of things. So I really got into building my own slot cars. And that was following a passion for Formula One. I was a massive, you know, even younger, I was a massive fan of Jim Clark. Mm. And, you know, because he was a sort of the ideal boy's hero, Jim Clark, modest and, you know, just a genuine nice guy, but with fantastic ability and courage and so forth. Yeah, so that's sort of, you know, I had a foundation there in making models. And I used to be on my knees in a corner of my parents' living room with a soldering iron and kind of a pair of pliers bending brass wire up into chassis and soldering them together. Yes, that's probably... And then the other thing is I did have a history in making stuff. I built a reflecting telescope when I was around 14 years old and cut and polished the mirror, just built the whole thing, which was quite an achievement. And I had been making some musical instruments as well. So I had a passion for making stuff.
Oh, wow.
And always overreaching and doing stuff that was way outside my skill set or, you know, ability. But nevertheless, you know, that's something that comes invaluable later on, doesn't it?
Yeah, and presumably learning. Like, you try and build something, you haven't got a clue. You learn a lot in the process.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. You also learn a lot about ambition and disappointment and kind of all of those, you know, life's general lessons are learned as well. Later on then, having sort of dropped, you know, that sort of all dropped away, I got on with my young hippie life and kind of ended up living in the country near to my sister in West Somerset. And looking for a job, I found my way to the first model making company. Mm. And the guy that I was working for was building a model village called Tuctonia that was going to be eventually, we ended up working on site near on the south coast.
Yeah.
And the Tuctonia was, we built, it was the best of British architecture, and that was the billing.
Right.
We built a bunch of notable London buildings, the Treasury, Horse Guards Parade, Big Ben, the Houses of Parliament, all at, say, just for an idea of scale, Big Ben was probably about 3 metres high, something like that.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay, so yeah.
Pretty big buildings. Anyway, that was a kind of, you know, fun reintroduction to making models.
Yeah. In this sort of process of building these buildings and stuff and at the time, how do you even like start to build a replica? And I'm presuming are they like exact scale replicas, or are they just kind of like smaller?
You're talking about Tuctonia and those buildings.
Yeah, the buildings.
You know, things have evolved a bit since then. But we would say, so we had drawings that were in the public domain of these buildings, you know, in terms of plans, elevations, but mostly it was photographs. We were working from photographs. And we used all kinds of crazy techniques. I remember we built the old London Bridge with houses on it, you know, the medieval London Bridge. And I remember visiting visiting the post office, which this was in a little tiny village called Stogumba in West Somerset. So we were working in a sort of loft, garagey type of space. And there it is, the London Bridge. And I remember popping down to the post office, which was a tiny little store and post office. You know, the counter was about 2 metres long. The whole room actually was probably only about 4 metres square post office. And buying boiled sweets. I bought boiled sweets, layers cobbles. A variety of different shapes. But what we were doing, the technique was building master components. That is a thread that's run right the way through, actually, to what we're currently doing, is that we're making master components, say boiled sweets, spaghetti, or in the current situation, beautifully CNC machined from CAD.
Yeah.
patterns is what, you know, that's the traditional sort of term, but we call them master components as well. And then we're putting those into rubber models. So that's what we were doing with Tuctonia as well. We'd make a pattern for each component, put it into a rubber mold, and then cast resin into it.
Okay.
Just as we do now.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know how they were made at all. Like, I thought...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that the evolution of amalgam model making and then into amalgam collection, making cars, making Formula One cars and so on. There's a thread that runs right the way through there in that we use that resin casting technique. And it became, so it was pretty rough and ready with something like Tuctonia. But later on, when we started amalgam, working for people like Dyson and Foster's and so on, if you wanted to repeat an object or a feature in an architectural model, or in the case of a product for Dyson, we did lots of other product work as well. What you were trying to do with those product models is make a visually identical, as much as possible, replica of the product that will eventually be coming out. And in the sort of mid to late 80s, there was a company in Japan, probably from the early 80s, called MCP, that they recognized that there was a need for replicas, marketing and testing and just product, design development.
Yeah.
There was a need for making full-size models of a product design in a way that actually replicated the kinds of plastics, the injection mold plastics were used for the final production. Using a system that you could use, create very small numbers, so you can make one or three or five Dyson vacuum cleaners and, put them in front of people and, start to test them and use them as well. So they developed these resins and a machine for vacuum casting and a whole kind of ecology around this ability to make resin cast replicas of what will ultimately be injection molded multi-component assemblages. So we were doing that as amalgam model makers, the general model making company.
Yeah.
We were doing that for a number of product designers and using that system. And at some point during that, it must have dawned on me that this was, it was feasible to make model cars, big scale, using that technique. So that's how we came upon that. There is a thread that runs through
all of the things, And then presumably materials and processes must have changed. Like, you said the introduction of these techniques, but up to now, this must have changed quite a lot with CAD and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, not the materials, strangely, not something I thought about for a while, but, even that early Tuctonia, they're slightly different, but not that.
Yeah.
They're not radically. I think that the range of resins that we can use to cast to replicate tires and clear windscreens and headlight lenses and so forth, that has evolved. But that probably reached its, that was ripe and pretty much, had arrived where it is now by 1990, something like that. There's a huge range of resins around by then. But the biggest thing is CAD. When we started making, for instance, the first Formula One cars, we just got 2D drawings from Williams or Jordan.
Okay. Yeah.
So even when we started with Ferrari in 1998, we were still just getting 2D. And they were by that time using CAD to design the car.
Yeah.
But they weren't about to share that with any model for obvious reason. And it took a period of time before we actually developed the trust and they started to share that the full CAD with us. So that's a major change, that we started off with 2D and now we're just getting full CAD for whatever car. And then another parallel change is that when we're making classics, that we do a digital scan. We just started the development process for an Aston Martin DB5 about a week and a half ago. And a scan was done on the customer's car, the customer who's kicking off the project with an order for his car.
Yeah.
He was there in New York, just a bit north of New York at Bedford Hills. And he's got his DB5 stored at Haggerty's Garage and Social. I don't know if you've heard about that.
I've not come across it, no.
You should definitely talk to them. It's great.
I'll check it out.
Love it. I mean, you know, just an amazing... They've got locations in something like 4 or 5 spots in the States.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, it's a storage spot for your, you know, your precious car.
Yeah.
But you can kind of hang out there and...
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People have events, get your car serviced, whatever other, you know,
car all the stuff
you want are all available there. But a beautiful location anyway. And so we digitally scanned this DB5, interior and exterior and engine bay. And then we've captured in 3D data, you know, really accurately, I mean, ridiculously accurately, to a very small fraction of a millimeter of accuracy.
Yeah.
I checked out actually because we were the partners who did the actual scanning process. They were using a particular Creaform hand scanner that we haven't seen before. And I just wanted to check out what the accuracy was. And it's to about a 40th of a millimeter. That's the accuracy.
It's pretty small.
So, you know, more than we need, because we're going to shrink it down to 1/8 scale anyway.
Yeah.
I suppose that, you know, at least a quarter. So that's ridiculously over accurate. And then we'll take a 1,000 pictures at the same time. You know, but that's, you know, parallel to that evolution of the availability of CAD for us to make models. You've got the evolution of that scanning technology, which is really, that's grown fast.
So when you get given, okay, let's say this DB5, it's been scanned down to a 40th of a millimeter, which presumably then means actually the sort of scan needs to be cleaned, because if there's a bit of dirt on the car, you've got a big chunk of dirt in your scan and you're like, okay, and you've got to smooth, you know, sort of do some cleaning and whatnot of the final thing. How, and I guess it's probably depends, but how much detail do you go to in the models in terms of like stuff you can't see? Like, how far apart can you take a car?
We're not, that's not our shtick, you know, that's not our, our approach to model making. We're really wanting to model everything you can see.
Okay.
So that it is really a perfect representation. You know, the target being that if you take a picture of it, it's next to impossible to tell the difference between the model and the real car.
Yeah.
And there are people who are, you know, really tremendously interested in doing, I mean, there's, you know, aircraft modelers who put all the rivets on the interior of the, you know, and then they seal it up at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Now, that is really, that's something that, you know, I totally understand the thinking and the kind of passion for doing that, but it's not what we do. What our thing is to put in all of the effort, all of the concentration into the, and when we say the visible parts, that means if you open the bonnet and the engines in there, you know, that we're really going crazy on the engine detail. So it's not, you know, sometimes you do what we call curbside models that don't have any opening doors or bonnet, and that's fine. Then you're not going to be seeing it underneath any or inside, you know. But if we do that, if we've got opening parts, then we're really fully showing everything that you can see when you open those parts.
Yeah. How did you get so it sounds like from the beginning, you've sort of aimed or pitched yourselves from the very, very beginning at the sort of the high end, making high end models.
Yes.
And then presumably that over time has then led to some of these partnerships, because you're just like, well, we're going to make the best we can and not do anything lower than that.
Yeah. And I think that is, if there was one thing that sort of defines who we are and, you know, what we want to be, it is that we just love working with the most exciting, the best, you know, and that informs the choice of, I was talking to our designer, who does we're doing a range of little sculptures, and which is gradually gathering momentum, and we'll have a range of those. And I was talking to the guy who does the designs, and just trying to bullet point out what it is that, you know, what's the selection process for the subjects, you know, and it's not, you know, that is a major differentiator, I think, between different model companies, as well as the quality, the size and all that stuff, is what is it that you want to be doing? You know, for me, it's absolutely about the fastest, the, you know, the most extreme design. It's got to be extreme in some way or the other. And not in a sense of extreme because it's got 20,000 rivets, you know, that leaves me very unmoved. It's all about the excitement of the experience of the thing, whether it's something that is, you know, Formula One cars, period Formula One cars, you know, the kind of connection that you can get to Jim Clark or, you know, just doing something with Jackie Stewart at the moment. But those people, Nuvolari, haven't been able to have a chat with Nuvolari as he's no longer with us. But the, you know, people that are really heroes of their time.
Yeah.
And the connection that you can have, the model really kind of takes you to all of the other stuff that you've got in your head and heart about those people and the period and what was happening. And the more convincing and more beautiful the model is, you know, the better it is, the better it kind of takes you, transports you to that experience, even though you can't be there for real. So that's really important. Yeah. Very, very high end is the most important. And that can be high end in many different ways, but that's the big thing.
Has that meant taken you to sort of led you to meeting a lot of people and seeing a lot of cars that you're like, I never thought I would see throughout this process?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's lots of people that I haven't met that I would love to have met. And lots of occasions when I've been sort of struck dumb and useless in a conversation. No conversation because I'm sort of like, you know, awestruck. But a good example of that, actually, I mean, it's not just about the people. I think it's about the cars as well, as you say. Mm. And a great example of that is with Ralph Lauren. So we went to digitally scanned the cars that Ralph Lauren had sent to an exhibition in Paris. He had in 2009 or 2010.
Yeah.
He had an exhibition in Paris and he sent across 17 cars, which were the sort of creme de la creme of his, you know, in his judgment, the creme de la creme of his collection.
Which means they're pretty good.
We ended up scanning three or four of those in the, it's the applied arts section of the Louvre, Les Arts Décoratifs.
Yeah.
So we scanned those in the museum, but the rest of them, we went to his garage in two sessions.
Oh, nice.
Which is just north of New York, but a stone's throw from the Haggerty garage and social, in fact. It's obviously where everybody's crazy about cars.
It's a place, yeah.
And so I got to meet Ralph, which was not a kind of lengthy conversation or anything, but it was quite interesting meeting Ralph Lauren. The cars, amazing, just to be, especially in that kind of environment when you're, you know, I wasn't doing the scanning.
Yeah.
That would be done and is still done. You know, we bring somebody in to do that.
Yeah.
Because the technology is evolving all the time and it would be crazy for us to buy into that for such a small amount of usage.
Yeah.
But I also, alongside the scanning going on, I will take of each car about, there it is, Ralph's cars. What a fantastic, beautifully presented as well, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, some serious, serious bits of kit. He has such a sick collection.
Just amazing cars. And so I was taking photographs. So I took about 1,000 photographs of each car, which of course means that I've got to open everything up, get inside, you know, root around, and just really get fully up close and personal with each of these cars. And I remember being the 250 TR, the Ferrari 250 TR that he's got, the Pontine Fender 57 car that he's got. I remember just photographing that and thinking, didn't realize, you know, how absolutely fantastic the lines of this car are.
Yeah.
You know, when you really kind of get close and start examining it in that way, because you've got to keep looking at different angles and kind of working out how to capture every detail in photographs, you realize what amazing, beautiful things they are, really. And even the engine, you know, the other thing I remember being blown away by on that trip He's got a Count Rossi. He modelled the Count Rossi Mercedes that he's got, which is sort of the car that Batman would have had if he'd been around.
Okay. This is a cool thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's an amazing car. But looking at the engine detail on that, and you just think, whoa, you know, the people that were creating same technology, actually, for the engine and the inlet manifolds, all of those cast parts. Okay, they're casting in aluminium, not resin, but there's a, you know, there's another thread joining it all together there. But just the fact that they were never satisfied with just doing something which was functional, they had to, even if they were not actually decorating it in the most obvious way, you know, with whatever ribs or whatever, some detail, the way, you know, things are formed to be more elegant than they need to be, you know, people making those parts wouldn't be able to keep themselves from doing a really over the top job on them.
It is. You look at some of the designs from this sort of period and some of these cars and you go like, I wish we designers could have this free form ability to design nowadays that they sort of did back then. Cause you couldn't make a car like this and people wouldn't make a car like this, but like, they're so amazing.
The story is that Count Rossi sketched out what he wanted for that car on a napkin when he was having a meal with the, I can't remember who the design, maker was, but he gave them the sketch of what he wanted it to look like.
No, it's and your point actually about taking photos, looking around, I found this as a photographer, but I've never probably photographed anything to the level that you would for making the models. But I think a lot of people will resonate with, let's say, even just like washing a car. Like if you wash a car, like really seriously wash a car, you notice so much stuff and pay attention to loads of things that you just haven't seen before because you're like, ooh, oh, what's under there? And like you touch the lines and everything. When you're doing these cars, the sort of the finish on the car and the model that's being represented, most of the time is that kind of like fresh out of the factory, or in terms of like it's got a fresh coat of paint on it, there's no like patina, and then has this changed?
Absolutely, that's the general, you know, that's the normal approach, and we do also make small editions and weathered models, but I think that's most people's expectation and desire is that even if it's a race car, that they'll see it, you know, just polished, ready to get onto the grid before the race starts. But I, you know, there's also a case for having a weathered, patinaed model, and we do small editions of those, which are, you know, additional price. But all of that work is done by the team here in Bristol.
How much sort of, let's say you don't, I can't remember off the top of my head what you've done that's been a sort of weathered. I feel like you've done some race cars, maybe like a 917, something like that. Yes. To get them to sort of look weathered and whatnot, presumably there is a lot of sort of like artistry to go into that process.
We've got two different scales that we're doing weathered editions at, 1 to 8, which is, you know, our core product and the thing we made our name with, and 1 to 18 that we started into about 4 years ago. And, you know, the 1 to 18 models will take a good half to three quarters of a day to do each one. And the 1 to 8 scale will be several days for each one. And it is, there's a lot of different techniques used, you know, using an airbrush is the obvious kind of thing for the kind of dirt, you know, the fine spray of mud and grime that you get on the car. But then there's a whole bunch of kind of special techniques of brushing and dragging and, you know, and it's interesting to see at Daytona, we're looking at models that we've weathered that raced at Daytona.
Yeah.
Is that they seem to get horrendously punished. I mean, even more so than Le Mans. I don't know what Daytona drivers were up to.
I wonder why that really is. I wonder what's so specific about Daytona. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It must have been lots of really brutal overtaking. And maybe people are coming from stock car, you know, racing, which is pretty brutal.
A lot of like hanging behind other cars as well.
Yeah, yeah. So you get lots of massive kind of rubber streaks down the side where somebody's wheels are.
It's always amazing. I've been to like a couple of sort of endurance races and a couple of GT3 ones and stuff like that. And seeing the cars afterwards. It's like, they're just, you look at them and they've, nowadays they're pretty good with like the duct tape. They have like different colored duct tape for different sections, so they sort of maintain the liveries and stuff. But you look at these cars and you're just like, that is been seriously kind of destroyed, but it's still going round, still whatever. And then occasionally you'll hear, I think it was like a couple of years ago at Le Mans, it was an LMP2 car, nearly won outright. I can't remember what team it was. And the car, it won its class, but it nearly won the whole thing because everyone else had a bit of a fit. And I think it was a Jackie Chan racing car. And someone washed the car after the race. But like, no one knew that this was going to happen. It was not the plan. And then it was going to go to like Goodwood to be displayed. And just someone was like, okay, cool. Let's prep the car, whatever. I was like, no, don't do it.
A couple of things. One is we've got a set of photographs that were shared by Mercedes of the W196 and mid-1950s cars, which dominated Formula One Grand Prix racing. And, you know, back in the day, photographs that are taken probably trackside, I would imagine, and then they've got a couple of guys to hold up a big greasy sheet and wobble it around a bit behind, like, you know, with a long exposure in the camera, so that the background turns into a sort of slightly mucky blur. And my God, those cars were absolutely driven to death. You know, I mean, they're just utterly knackered. They look like the kind of car that I would buy for 50 quid in 1970. You know, they've just been to hell and back, completely worn out. And then the other one is I visited the Audi garage a few years ago, where they keep all of the significant race cars. Mm. And as much as possible, they keep them without, you know, as you say, they didn't get accidentally washed at the end of the Le Mans race. You know, they managed to get them back to the garage in one piece, so to speak. But and they, you know, the legendarily, I'm sure this isn't true, actually, but if you've got a sensitive nose, that you could still smell the champagne on the, mingled with the mud on the car.
Nice.
Yeah, but they're all, you know, the whole rows and rows of dirty cars, basically.
I think there's a lot of, like, value in that. Like, if the cars are never going to get used, which those ones, you know, they're never going to get used again, they're too sort of valuable, maybe they'll do a couple of things. But when you can sit in, let's say you bought, you could sit in a car and let's say Jim Clark drove it and you know that, like, maybe he was the last person to drive it or, like, he's definitely sat in that seat and you can see the bum groove and you're like, oh, like, and there's a little scratch where whatever, you know, in the pedal box and stuff. Like that, those things really do like bring back that sense of being there, I think, for a lot of people. With the Ferrari stuff, how did that come about?
So that's sort of following that, the tale of the desire to work with the best. But we started into Formula One with what at the time I thought was the best because they were winning all the championships. We started with Jordan actually, but so we had a couple of years working with Jordan Grand Prix.
Yeah.
They were doing reasonably well, I think, at the time. I'm trying to remember where they tended to be on the grid, but you know, I think it was 3, 4, 5, that kind of positioning.
Yeah.
And then it might have only been after a year, we started in with Williams. And this was 95, 96, it was probably 96, 97, 98 that we were working with Williams.
Yeah.
And we continued after that as well. But they were winning the championship every year and they were massively dominant. Damon Hill. That was the dominant car, but it wasn't the most glamorous or the most, you know, exciting. Kind of pretty, okay, they did have a significant history, but not for that long before that. Anyway, somewhere along the line, one of the guys in our team said, you know, we really should be making an effort to connect with Ferrari and see if we can. And Ferrari, everybody was recognising that in the run-up to 2000, you know, by 97, 98, 99, everything was going in a great direction because you had the dream team of Jean Todt and Ross Brawn and Michael Schumacher. So, it became really... It was clear that we needed to get involved with them.
Yeah,
and I just reached out to them And it, actually quite good timing, really, in that they were just beginning to recognize the power of the brand beyond selling cars.
Yeah.
I mean, they did have some merchandise, I think, but it was really limited. Mm. And it was all handled, you know, pushed out to licensors, the merchandise design and so forth. So licensees. So when I got in touch with them, it was they just set up a licensing department called Ferrari Idea, which was the and Ferrari Idea was to take, you know, what, give us your ideas, guys, you know, extend the brand. And so perfect timing. Only one person in the department was one person. A guy called Vittorio Avogadro. And he turned out to be he understood where we were coming from. Mm. The one thing I remember from that is that he was much more impressed by the fact that we'd worked with Norman Foster than he was by the fact that we'd worked with Williams. Which is quite amusing, really. But, I mean, it tells you, you know, that that's typical Ferrari, isn't it? That they're very sort of high-end design-oriented.
Yeah.
So we started in with them in 1998. I think we just made one model of the 98 car and then a small number of the 99 car. And in 2000, the F1 2000, we made, I think it was 200 1/8 scale models, four editions of 50 that all sold through.
How big is a 1/8 scale, like long?
60 centimeters, 2 feet. Okay.
Yeah. So you started making those ones and then did the race cars and then did that just slowly transition over time?
So working with them for longer. Sort of transitioned in jumps, really, in the sense that I remember having a meeting in Maranello with the guy who was heading up, you know, this was probably in about 2003, something like that. And by this time, the Ferrari idea, Ferrari licensing and merchandise had really grown in strength and it became a department of half a dozen people. You know, they're up to about 20 now.
Yeah.
And having a meeting with him, and he was saying, Mr. the President. They would never say Mr. Montezemolo. So Montezemolo was always known as the President.
The President, fair enough.
He sounds like a sort of South American Republic or something. But,
yeah, very Ferrari.
So the President says, you know, we'd really like you to make the current range of road cars, as well as the GT cars, as well as the race cars. And we just didn't have the capacity or the ability to do that at that time. And then, so eventually we did get around to that in 2005, started with modern cars, and we've done, so that was the F430, and we've made every Ferrari road car since then. There's been no gaps in the entire range of Ferrari road cars and the GT race cars and the Formula One cars. So we've modeled every single one of them.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And those are available. We're still making those. We're, you know, going back to the F430, making those for customers who want a bespoke model of their car. F430 doesn't crop up that often, but some of the, you know,
basic
cars do.
Once.
And then we started into doing, you know, shortly thereafter, into doing classic cars.
Yeah.
Which with Ferraris,
the iconic ones. And once you've done, let's say, with the Ferrari, like what? How long does that process take? They say, we've got a new car. Do they send you the CAD model for it?
They send us the CAD model. We're just currently developing the Daytona SP3.
Mm-hmm.
We've had the CAD for that for about 4 months, something like that. So it's pretty early on. In fact, we started to get the CAD for that before the design was entirely fixed. So there's no point us getting the CAD for it if it's still very much in flux. You know, they wouldn't do that, and there's no practical reason to do it. But once they've got to the point where it's just a few details that are being refined or material specifications are being considered with the interior, that kind of stuff, then we'll get the CAD. We'll get a few updates along the way, you know, of any elements that are a rear wing,
yeah,
perhaps, you know, that's suddenly taken a little bit of a design revision.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll get those. And then that the development process overall to get to a batch of models is around 9 months usually. Can okay. be done quicker, but it's a real, you know, bit of an ache to do that. Yeah, so the steps are we get the CAD, we rework the CAD in the sense that, hang on a second, there we go, let's get rid of an annoying little pop-up. We get the CAD and then we rework that CAD so that it works for the model. So right. clearly, you know, we're not doing that thing. You know, there have been a few insane model makers in history that have tried to replicate every component yeah. of a car.
Yeah.
And then build it all back together, you know.
Build the engine.
Yeah, well, that's not what we do. We're looking at how do we best make the exterior, all the visible parts,
yeah.
you know, work. What's the best way to make them break into parts that allows us to finish the
right.
paint finishes, the leather, whatever it is, you know, on and have it all come together in a satisfactory fashion. So there's a bunch of work that we've got to do on the CAD, which is removing a whole bunch of things that are yeah. relevant to us because they're completely invisible, and then adding a few things that allow us to
right.
put it together and so fix it together.
What sort of and the CAD drawing you get, does that have like bolts on it and stuff like that?
It could do. What we usually do, you know, if it's rivets, if it's a classic car, we're talking about rivets.
Yeah.
Then depending on what kind of rivets they are and whether they are, you know, if they're clean metal rivets, which sometimes does occur,
yeah.
then we wouldn't want to mold them in as part of the cast of a, let's yeah. say, you know, the nose cone of a Formula One car from the 1950s. You know, if it's painted, then we'll make the rivets part of the casting and paint over the whole okay. thing because that's what happened in the real yeah. car. If it's a, you know, if they're bare metal rivets on a painted finish, then we'll put those in separately off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Drill them and put them in.
And like, this process of you get this sort of the CAD model come to you, and presumably there's like 20,000 parts or whatever it is that makes up the car, and then
yeah.
it, or you know, many more or whatever. And then what does that sort of come down to? How many sort of parts or components are in your finish, let's say the eighth scales? Like roughly, I know it probably will change.
Yeah, lots of variation there because. Sort of surprisingly, but actually when you think about it, not so surprisingly, the simplest car to make, and that's reflected in the prices, you know, our prices are all reflecting the
time
amount of effort that goes in, you know, yeah. the hours and the number of parts and materials that go in there. But the simplest thing is a Formula One car, modern mm-hmm. one. Not so much the classics, because they're sometimes horrendously complex once you take cars off.
Yeah.
But the, yeah, and then, you know, medium in terms of the number of parts will be a modern road car.
Yeah.
And then the most complex are classics. If you, you know, the Bugatti 57SC, a 250 GTO.
Yeah.
Those are 250 GTO, I think I'm right in saying it's got, a model's got 2,240 parts in it.
Okay.
A Formula One car has got a lot less. It's probably, you know, just heading towards 1,000.
Yeah.
And a GT road car, you know, any of the classics, huge numbers of parts because there's a lot more visible on a car like that. When you open the bonnet, you're seeing right the way through to, you know, to a plate or maybe straight through to the tarmac underneath.
Yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah, just a lot more visible.
And then are they paint, are all the parts painted and then put together, or are the cars part assembled? Is it a blend?
They're all painted. I mean, apart, of course, from bare metal.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got spun wheels from a 1960s Formula One car, they'll be turned in aluminium.
Okay.
The rims of the classics, those are CNC turned.
Are they?
They have little tiny pockets. We machine... For each nipple, we machine a little pocket in from the back of, you know, the tire side of the rim.
Yeah.
And then a nipple with a hemispherical face goes into the back of that pocket
okay.
so that it's visible on the inside of the, you know, the spoke side of the rim. So a 250 GTO wheel has got 72 spokes and 72 nipples and about 20 other parts that go into the hub. So, you know, you're up to well over 150 parts.
Yes.
That's crazy. But so apart from those bits that are bare metal, or they could be, not that we very rarely, never, I think, use leather. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, real leather, because it is just grossly overscale and looks ridiculous, yeah. Looks like a Barbie doll. So all of those finishes are sprayed. We do sometimes use, for some of the more outlandish Lamborghini interiors, I remember, we actually managed to source materials that replicate a woven seat.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Fabric.
But tiny.
But that's pretty unusual, actually, to do that. So nearly all of that interior stuff is sprayed. Yeah, so we're spraying all of the parts separately and then assembling it. And then the only, you know, getting to your point, really, the only finishing that we're doing on a race car is deckling it all after it's assembled. Yeah. You know, we wouldn't be putting the decals on, or as the Americans like to keep pointing out to me, decals. This is great amusement and merriment when I start talking about decals with American colleagues.
Is that the same process, sort of, as if I was doing it at home, you know, maybe a bit of like soapy water, move them around?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we've got a lot of clevernesses that we, you know, little tweaks and techniques and stuff, obviously. One of the things that we do, which I think people probably still do, you know, do now on self-assembly models, is that we're replicating a carbon fiber, visible carbon fiber. We're doing that with the decals as well. We've got a range of, we'll print the decals to match the carbon pattern, because they have huge numbers of variations, and we lay all that on so that you get the right joint, the right alignment of the pattern and so forth. Some of that stuff that the Italians are absolutely crazy about, like Pagani,
carbon
fiber is out of this world.
So if you were doing like a carbon bonnet, like do you do any cars that are like painted carbon where you can see the carbon on the outside, like a I don't know, like a Bugatti or something? And so is that, how do you do that finish? Because that can't be a decal.
No, that is a decal, and then it's given a hefty old coat of clear lacquer polished back.
Oh, okay.
So it's not actually that dissimilar. The difference is that our pattern is a decal and the real one is the carbon fiber, but that's exactly what they'll do with the real thing as well. And you can tint, you know, sometimes Bugatti, for instance, oftentimes have tinted lacquers over their carbon fiber. One particular Ferrari customer is one of their most important customers, whose all of his cars have a sort of purple-blue tint to the carbon fiber.
All right.
Which Ferrari refused to do for him on the grounds that it wasn't tasteful enough.
He
always takes his cars along to have the lacquer stripped off, you know, brand new LaFerrari, take it down the refinishing shop.
There's like a few stories like this, of this sorts of situation where Ferrari often, even on the like things like LaFerrari and LaFerrari Perti, you can only get it in like five colors.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, you can only get it in five colours. It's like, but I want it in a different colour. So it comes out of Ferrari, goes down the road, goes back, and then it gets changed. You're like, fair enough.
Crazy. Now, I think that what I'm seeing in the last few years is that they've really pulled back on that kind of stuff, where they're, the whole point of that was a kind of an indicator of the requirement for respect.
Mm, okay.
You're only going to get to do what we tell you you're allowed to do. You know, we're in control of this situation. And I think that there's been a much softer, probably that was nurtured by Montezemolo gradually over the years since he left. You know, it's kind of reset to normal.
Yeah.
So you can get, even if you have got some horrible, tasteless idea, they will in fact do it for you.
Yeah. Which seems like somewhat fair. Like, you're spending the money. Like, if it's not a massive effort, you'd think, why not?
Seems entirely reasonable, doesn't it?
Yeah. And so with the Ferraris, like the production cars, you can now, can you spec it as part of your road car as a tick box option?
Yes, only since last year we started into a program thing. I mean, we've been making bespoke models for owners and significantly started with Ferrari with that way before anybody else.
Yeah.
We must have started that pretty soon, about 2006, I think, something like that, with the F430.
Yeah.
And so we've been doing that for a long time. And Ferrari have been tremendously... one of the things I do love about Ferrari is that at the same time as being, you know, that attitude of demanding respect and being really exclusive, that once you are invited in to be part of the team, they're extremely collaborative and
that's
pragmatic about things as well. They don't get obsessed with irrelevant details. Mm. They tune into the really important ones. I think that's a, you know, that's an amazingly powerful design approach as well. He's just not getting sucked into obsession about something, but kind of keeping your eyes on the, it's the experience that counts, you know?
Yeah. And
so historically that would mean that there were all kinds of really annoying kind of QC issues. But you know, latterly I've retained the good side of that and kind of taken it forward. And so we've, as I said, we've been making those bespoke models for a long time, but they've invited us in just recently. And obviously I was going to say that even before this recent development where it's become a tick box on the during the order process, that we were always invited along to Ferrari Racing Days, where the most significant, that's a really interesting mix of people at Ferrari Racing Days. We'd get to display models in the VIP lounge.
Okay, cool, yeah.
So there you get all drivers, the team owners, the they demand support from a local dealership, so all the important people from the dealership would be there. And fantastic, you know, that was a tremendously important invitation that we had about 10 years ago to start coming to the Ferrari Racing
Day. That's cool.
So that kind of connection and collaboration has been there all the time. But a couple of years ago, we started a program where now when you're ordering your Ferrari, you can order the model at the same time. It all goes through a process. If you come to us directly for a 1/8 scale bespoke model of your Ferrari, we can go to Ferrari and we can get the specification from them. They're happy to share that with us. But by doing it at the time of ordering, it means that as the specification is hardened, we can get the spec that we need properly packaged up as early as possible. And the other new thing about that is that they felt that there was a desire that even though most of the owners, you know, if you're buying a couple of hundred grand worth of car and you're lavishing another 50 or 100 grand on the
spec,
on this and that.
Yes.
Throwing in a model for £10,000 or whatever it is, a bit more than that, shouldn't be that much of an issue. So it's not about the price. It's about the fact, but they thought that 1/12 scale, a bit smaller than the 8 scale, would really be a great addition to the offering. Mm. So we've done that, and that's now just for Ferrari. People can't come to us directly for the 1/12 scale.
What about
when you're ordering the car?
Do you? There's a Chiron in 1/12 on the website, but is that
there
that's is. An old
that model? Was a that was not a bespoke model. It was just a limited edition.
Okay,
and I mean it might be that we. It's always very difficult to break into a new, in this world of models, it's all about, you know, is it old cars? Is it race cars? Is it, you know, new cars, Formula One, whatever? And then also the massive divider between different companies and their offerings is scale.
Okay.
So for us, when we started doing 18th scale, that was 4 years ago, we only really started to see that work properly for us, profitably, last year.
Okay.
And everything before that was just building the awareness and the, you know, the people's willingness to buy something with a different brand on it at a particular scale. And also at a higher price, because we're doing, you know, all of our models are hand on heart, you know, better than anything else that you can buy. So it means that the price is always higher.
Priced accordingly,
so
yeah.
That struggle, that barrier to get over. but 1/12 scale, you know, that's, we dabbled in it with the Chiron, and we also did a LaFerrari at 1/12 scale. Didn't really work out for us, and we sort of pulled back from it. But now with Ferrari saying, look, we want this to happen, we're going to support you, we're in there. And I think we'll find that other 1/12 scale models would follow in due course.
Mm. What? Okay. What is? How big is a 1/12?
1/12 is about 2 foot 60 yeah. centimeters long. So it's 2/3 of that.
Okay, that's quite
so
a good
it's
size.
About 16 inches, isn't it?
I like that size. That sort of
yeah, and it's got that's right. You know, Ferrari's estimation was that lots of customers would prefer. You know, that it was slightly not something you'd normally associate with somebody buying a Ferrari, but it would be a more modest
yes.
kind of display, you know. That there's definitely something about, you know, you have to be willing to be visibly crazy about your car to want to have a 1/8 scale model.
You do.
So it definitely filters out.
It kind of needs its own parking space at that point. Like, it's big enough that it's got to be on a plinth.
We've had a lot of at events like the Ferrari Racing Days. You often get guys who come up and go, yeah, I've got to have one of those. And then their wife is kind of following behind and says, what are you talking about? Where do you want to put that?
Yeah. I have some 1/46th maybe scale, like models of
143.
I've tried to get one of every car I've owned, which is and roughly the right specs, basically possible. But those are dinky, like they're small enough that I've got four kind of parked in, you know, 30 centimeters space, and it's not a problem. I like the bigger ones. I think probably 1/18th is that. That's probably quite a broad. Is it 1/18th that you could sort of generally buy from a lot of stuff? And then
that's about 9 or 10 inches long.
Yeah. That I like that, but then I have seen a couple of the. I think whenever I've seen some Amalgam models in various places, in Joe McCarry showroom, I think I saw a Ferrari one at one point in time. You get to see so much more when they get bigger. Like, they really start to pop out as well.
It is, there are some really crazy, oft-times Japanese model makers that this weekend, is Retromobile in Paris. And Retromobile, we've got a little display there with our French sales agent, Gregory. And he'll be working the crowd and getting around to speak to the ACO and whoever, you know, to talk about developing relationships. But there's a sort of upstairs merchandise spot at Retromobile, which is massive, actually, absolutely massive. Aftermarket stuff. There's a lot of models there. And I'm always amazed how many little, small, garage-sized operation Japanese companies are, who are selling 1/43rd scale models at insane prices, you know, like more expensive than our 1/8 scales. And it's, so, you know, 10, 15, 20 grand for a... And you just look at them and think, that is absolutely insane. Now, the thing is that you can use you can use your eyeglass and get in there and it is really amazing. So, you know, the value is in the miniaturization part. It's just like the astounding ability to make something so bloody tiny with so many parts. No matter how close you look, it still looks right. But the big advantage of the 1/8 scale is that it seems, and that's why we honed in on it. Sometimes we're asked to make 1/5 scale.
Mm.
So we make editions of models for Richard Mille. Mm-hmm. Each time, not every time, but about once every 2 years when he's doing a limited edition watch, he wants to, you know, and it's in partnership with a McLaren or now Ferrari or whatever. You know, he'd like to gift, it's not exactly gifting a model, but the model gets kind of bundled with the watch, if you like. An ugly way of putting bundling it. But he really likes 1/5 scale, which is very typically Napoleonic French, isn't it? It's a metric scale, 1/5. And that's bigger. And on the face of it, you'd think, oh, bigger, must be better. But I don't think so. And I'm not the only one who thinks that. Is that they weirdly, that bigger size, it starts to look a bit toy-like somehow, even if it's got all the same detail.
I know what you mean.
It just doesn't work.
Because I guess the bigger you get, the more it's going to compare to the real car rather than being like a shrunk car. And there's something about tiny things. And then as you get that realm, you're like, ah, okay, this is not real, but it's getting towards the size that it should be real.
Now, this is a weird thing, is that when you then go bigger to 1/4 scale, suddenly it comes back into, you know, somehow it seems to work better. I mean, this could be all
give in your head. Who knows?
But I don't seem to be the only one. And for 1/8 scale, this is something I noticed many years ago. Jordan, when Jordan closed shop, when he sold out, they had a final kind of event. I can't remember where that was, but anyway, it was a race circuit event. And they took along, you know, all of the Jordans, you know, sort of goodbye Eddie kind of a thing. And they had a row of cars in the garage, you know, a number of garages with the open air.
Yeah.
Probably a good word, actually. Anyway, they had a row of the cars in the garage and with models beside them. And if you looked at the models, you'd immediately sort of, and if you compared one model with another, you could really much more easily understand the kind of whole design and how it evolved from one car to another. Much more difficult to take that in with a real car. Yeah. You're only ever looking at one, unless you step back, you know, 20 meters.
Yeah.
You're not seeing the whole thing as one vision. It's just you're looking at, you're focusing in on detail. So it is, 8 scale is very satisfying. It's a really good scale to work at.
It's so funny how this all like, there's like various bits that are picked by different people for whatever reason as their like your niche. How, materials wise, you said they're predominantly the same, but you're saying you're using metal for the wheels and stuff. So a lot of the metal parts, metal, or is it only like the wheels?
It does depend what it is. So it's to do with the finish. That's, you know, spun aluminium or machined aluminium is really difficult to replicate in any other way than just making it real aluminium.
Okay.
So we'll go to extraordinary lengths to make aluminium parts that are really polished bare aluminium out of the real metal. Whereas if you look at gearbox or engine casings, which are rough casting aluminium, sand castings, it's incredibly difficult to make those look correct at scale, casting them as aluminium, and it's got massive restrictions on, you know, the technology really restrains, you know, reduces your ability to make it look correct.
Yeah.
So those, we would nearly always cast them in resin and then use a spray paint finish.
Yeah.
And that comes, one of the things that came from the original architectural model making, is that we became, as a company, you know, we kind of built up a skill set about replicating finishes on buildings using spray techniques. And that was kind of carried across. It's evolved lots since then, but that's where that originates from, is the desire to make things in the most appropriate material to make them, you know,
look real, but in the scale.
But at the scale, but also get a finish on them that is incredibly convincing. So we use CNC machining, you know, I mentioned about rims and spokes and nipples and so forth, you know, and other kind of really polished machined parts. I'm trying to think of examples for that, but there's not that many. It's mostly wheels, actually. And then we also use what the British call white metal casting, but everybody else calls spin casting. But it's using a pewter alloy that you cook up to its melting point, which is much, much lower than, because it's an alloy chosen for its low melting point. It's a really low melting point. And then you pour that into a mold, into a centrifuge, into a pair of rubber discs that you've put your patterns, the original parts that are going to be replicated between the two rubber discs. You cook them up and the two halves of the discs become a mating pair of molds, you know, like a clamshell pair of molds. And you spin that pair of rubber discs, clamp together, pour the molten metal in, and it pushes out into through channels in the rubber to create the pieces. So we use quite a lot of that. And that's a classic that used to be used in, you know, until the 1970s or 80s, I think, when die-cast really took over. But there used to be quite a lot of small-scale models that were made using white metal casting. So we're using that for some small metal parts. And it's got a very nice finish on it that looks a lot at scale.
Yeah.
like a foundry cast real part.
Interesting.
Does that answer the question?
It does. And I can totally see how, like, if you cast something large, the surface finish is the same as if you cast it tiny, but it doesn't look like a tiny version of the big one. It's just the same.
Yes, totally. And I think the really kind of obvious and kind of convincing example of that is that leather one that I used earlier. Is that sometimes people say to us, can you put a leather, can you make leather seats for me? Yes, we can. No problem. We can actually do that. Not a problem. But it doesn't, it just looks rubbish.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like it really does have Barbie doll written all over it. It's horrible. And we did so many years ago with the first Aston Martin that we did, the DB9, I think it was. We were asked for the leather supplier, which is Lock of Weir. I think it's Lock of Weir.
Don't know.
That's the right name. But they're the sort of biggest competitor to Connolly's and the Italian leather suppliers. But they were a partner of Aston Martin. And they said, could you make a DB9 model completely covered in leather? Which we did. Which was really surprisingly, because it wasn't, trying to look like something.
Yeah.
It wasn't a model seat, which you want to look correct. Yeah. It was just a weird art object. And it worked really well, actually. We had them scarf the leather down to 0.5 millimeter thick. And then I did quite a bit of it. To just make the leather slightly damp and it forms. Really,
okay, yeah.
For your red snaps and stuff. And just bonded it on with white glue, with wood glue.
Nice.
Worked a treat.
Nice.
That's great.
That's quite cool. Do you have moving parts?
So moving parts in the sense of opening bonnets.
Okay. Steering boots, wheel?
Doors. And wheels, yes. Although on Formula One cars, we tend to screw the wheels to the base because they're so heavy and the suspension is so fragile.
Okay.
Once it's scaled down, it starts to get more and more fragile.
Yeah, yeah.
But generally speaking, we're just about to launch an Aston Martin DB4 GT Zagato. Yeah. And we presented the model to the designer, Julian Nunn, who was the designer working on the continuation.
Okay,
And he being the Aston Martin's, most deeply knowledgeable expert on the DB40 Zagato. And he looked at it and said, the one thing that, because of course they're all different, aren't they? Those cars.
Yeah.
Particular cars, everyone's hammered out, sheets of metal. So they're all radically different. And he said that they had scanned, when they were doing the continuation, they scanned 6 different cars to see if they could nail down the ideal, what's the one we want to use. And eventually they used a combination of all of them.
Okay, interesting. But they didn't just pick one.
He said that not only were they utterly different from each other, but they were also not symmetrical in the sense. Left and right sides were all quite different.
Yeah.
So the car that we've modelled is one VEV, which is one of the two really famous cars. 2 VEV is a bit more famous, right? So we've modelled 1 VEV. We scanned that car, and we've precisely replicated the rear wheel positioning within the rear wheel arch. But when I visited the car to do the photo shoot of it, I walked into the garage it was in, and I immediately thought, whoa, that's really weird. It's got a very unsatisfactory space between the rear wheel and the rear wheel arch.
Yeah.
And that car designers, this is one of their obsessions. They're, like getting that spatial relationship between the wheel and the arch.
Yeah,
and,
very important.
It's got to be absolutely perfect, And so Julian Nunn looked at this and said, it might be right, but I don't like it. And when you look at the other cars, then it's not right. There's for some reason, the wheels on one VEV are set further in. It could well be that it's because the rims, the offset of the rim to the hub is different. When you lace the spokes together, you can bring the wheel in or out. So we're just in the process of making some adjustments to meet his requirements.
Well, that's an interesting point, because there's some manufacturers, not all, But they launch a car, and you'll see some press photos, and it will have a wheel gap that looks normal, small, looks really good. And then you see the final road car, and it's a bit different. It's often seen on Ferraris. So in the models, let's say of the Ferraris, let's say, I don't know, 458, 488, etc., is that a 100% exact representation of a delivered car, or is it the more slightly optimized because it looks better version?
We haven't got, it's not that we've got a policy or a sort of strict road route that we follow with that, but I think that we're always working with the original CAD.
Mm.
And you probably expect that to be more like, you know, I'm guessing that for the show, you know, the display car, Geneva and so on, that they're just tweaking the suspension to make it look sweeter.
Put some bricks in the boot or whatever. They're just like, they want them to be a bit lower.
Like a few lead blocks in there, so we're following what we see in the photo shoot and in the CAD, which I think is much more likely to be the final delivered.
That's an interesting one. Have you had any sort of unexpected struggles or things that you've had to overcome over the last, quite a long time that sort of popped up that you didn't expect?
Yeah. Almost every model.
Yeah.
That's not true, but there are, you know, I reckon the smooth paths are the exception.
Mm.
Because there's so much... You know, particularly if you're dealing modern GT cars and modern Formula One cars are actually the easiest because the data is so nailed down. I mean, I'll tell you what, as I'm just saying that, I was just thinking Formula One cars, is that one of the very early days when we were doing the first Ferraris, the 99 and 2000 cars, that they at the time were using a fluorescent paint.
Okay.
I don't know if you won't remember it, Sam, but you might. But it was they Marlborough, you know, they
created.
The legend was that we heard from the guys at Ferrari that the colour was created, that Montezemolo went into the paint shop at Maranello and said, guys, we need to make a new colour for Marlborough. And they said, well, what do you want? He said, show me the paint cupboard. And he said,
nice.
I want it to be a bit like that fluorescent red and a bit like the Rosso Corsa. So they just took two tins, mixed them up together.
That was it, yeah.
And what I do know is that paint, back in the day, they were being sponsored by PPG paints, Ferrari. Mm. That was actually on the car, you know, PPG as a brand on the under tray. But they were actually using Glasurit.
Oh, paints. Cheeky.
Yes. And I don't know why that was, just because it was an establishment and they were with the Glasurit paints, I have no idea. We had our paints for the models supplied by Glasurit as well, because that is a nice easy path to making sure you get it, you know, perfectly right. And they told us that this was the mix that they got told to supply for everybody who was doing models. Actually, we'd be the only ones making models at that level. But it would be show cars or any other usage of this colour. Mm. They supplied people the right paints. And they were not paints, these two that Montezemolo, I mean, you know, this is the legend, but it sounds totally feasible, that what he'd chosen were two incompatible paint systems. One of them was a two-pack, and the other one was a base coat system. And they just bunged them together and it kind of worked. Yeah. But what happened was, and we ran up against this, so this, I'm answering the question about the kind of issues because it went on for ages, is that it would behave really badly when you put a final lacquer coat on this dodgy mixture of two paints that shouldn't really be mixed together, then the lacquer coat would cause all kinds of problems. And we got problems with it crazing, more than it had a sort of slightly very, very subtle kind of wrinkle finish on it. We'd have to buff it back. It's interesting to see those models come back now, because we every now and then we'll get one of them, you know, from 20 plus years ago, coming back for a repair or whatever, you know, that we get sight of one. And the paint's absolutely fine, but it hasn't gone nasty over a period, but it was driving us
mad at the time.
When it was in the get stuff out the door. So that's the kind of thing that can happen. I think the real challenge is, you know, more often than not, the kind of things that you come up against are, we just recently created the first 1/8 scale Ford GT40 models. And the thing about that is that you've not got, you know, the car that you're using as the basis is the right chassis, but it's, again, it's been through, you know, back all in the day, you'd finish with it at Le Mans, wouldn't you? And go, okay, let's, you know, repurpose this, tear the body off and replace it with whatever. You know, even if that wasn't part of the story, a complete rebodying, there'd almost certainly be numerous accidents and, you know. So by the time we get to scan it now, nine, it's been modified to hell, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's really just done. Very, very difficult to know. And sometimes we'll do that with, you know, that car is one of the examples, is that you look at it and the data that we're getting, you just know that it's not quite right from the, you know, from the scan. So we have to go back to original photographs and start to feed that back into the equation.
And where do you pick that point in time? Do you generally go, okay, we're going to do that car, or you go, we're going to try and do the first or the last iteration or what?
Yeah, definitely choose a specific event. With Formula One cars that we were making at the time of the race, you know, sometimes we wouldn't. I mean, it's really hard to know during a season which, you know, you want to get a model made and meet people's requirement for a model during that season. But you don't know how it's all going to go, and quite often it'll be the winning race, won't it, in Abu Dhabi or whatever. That's the one that really you should have modelled, but you need to get something out before that. So sometimes we make generic launch cars at the beginning of the season. Not the launch car, but the first race car, but it's still a generic car.
Yeah.
But it's certainly, in terms of classics, absolutely got to be the specific race day, and then you have to dig deep to find the archive photography to let you know what's going on.
And then start making. If someone wants to get a car made, there's presumably all the cars you've made to date, not necessarily all of them are available, but like, let's just say it was Ferraris because you've done a bunch of production cars. Mm. What do? They just call you up and say, I want a 430 in a certain color, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we'll ask them for F430s, very unusual. I think we've only made one or two over the last couple of years. But, you know, more usually it's something more recent than that. The vast majority of the bespoke models that we're making are, actually, that's not true, because a lot of classics, Ferrari Dino, you know, get a fair few orders for bespoke versions of those. Call that person back. Yes, so classics, we are relying on a set of photographs of the real car, and as much specification data, you know, paint reference and so forth. But usually those cars, somebody will have, you know, they've probably had it resprayed or somewhere along the line, you know, there'll be a reference for the actual paint that was used on it. So usually pretty easy to get that, pull that all together, but not as easy as a, you know, a current Ferrari or McLaren or one from the last few years. We can get the full specification from Ferrari or McLaren, and that makes life really a lot easier. So yes, people can give us a call, send us an email, and we'll ask them for the specification. If they haven't got it, just give us the VIN number and we'll get that for them. And then we set the process going, which is a lot longer than we'd like it to be, but then, you know, it does take a long time.
How long?
It's at the moment, it's around about 30, 35 weeks from order to delivery of a bespoke on the scale.
And then what if someone wants to do a car you haven't done?
So we can make unique models, and we have done that. We've made one-offs, the Ferrari 1967 312 Formula One car. Before we'd actually made the additional 1/8 scales, we made a one-off for the owner of us, one of the GT40s. And those generally were suggesting to people that we make those at a bigger scale, because the cost of bringing it all together just to make a one-off model is insane. There's another way that we go about doing this, is that if somebody wants us to make a model of their car, and if we feel that that car will in future be, you know, it's worth it, benefit for wider customer base, then we invite them to invest in it and pay in tranches for the development process, because that's the only way we can, you know, the cash flow is always an issue for us. So it helps us out with the cash flow. We get to the point where we make the first models, and then we pay them back in tranches as we sell each model.
Okay.
But the, you know, unique one-offs, we'd always suggest somebody has that in 1/5 scale, or that, as I say, I don't like 1/5 scale very much, but better still, 1/4 scale, 1/4, which is monster, you know, 4 feet long. Great. Love it. And, yeah, it's very high prices. We can do the price for doing that, a one-off, if we can do a curbside model with no opening parts.
Yeah.
And depending on what the car is, you know, that starts at about £55,000-£60,000. And then if we do the whole shebang, do the fully opening and in engine bay detailed, interior detailed, you're up into the £150,000.
Wow. So it's quite a commitment.
It is, but then,
I get it. I get why people do it. Not like, not just the price. Yeah, I can see the process. And
I think, you know, it depends how wealthy you are.
Exactly.
It really is that, you know, the people that we're talking about are not stupid. They're not going to waste money on something that is, you know, they'd like to hope, and I would expect, that the value of the model will increase over time. At the very least, kind of keep its real value, you know, over the...
And sort of, I guess, sort of track with the real car price a little bit, like...
Yeah.
As that goes up. And then do you get...
And I totally think that's a really important psychology as well, is that people will not... It doesn't matter how... You know, if you love your Morgan three-wheeler or something.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's lots of people that love their Morgan three-wheeler more than a Ferrari Dino owner happens. You know, you could find two extremes.
Yeah.
But there's no way that you can bring yourself to spend £150,000 on a Morgan three-wheeler. It doesn't make any sense. But it does sort of, you know, there's a little mental calculation that goes on that says, yeah, that does make sense. If my LaFerrari is worth $3 million or whatever, you know. Then,
do you get people... buying, and this is something that I'd always like thought about doing, and I haven't really done, but slightly, it was, if they've got a car that they've like loved, and it's, you know, maybe it might have been an investment as well, and then they sell it, do people get models of cars kind of as they're going, as the main one is heading off?
That has happened. It's, can't say that it's a sort of really regular thing, but it's something that I expect more and more. Because we've made, for the LaFerrari, for instance, we supplied Ferrari with models that were gifted to each customer.
Okay, yeah.
So we know from the number of models that we made that had fully opening doors of the LaFerrari, that a lot of those customers came and bought the fully opening version as well. Okay. So they had the gift version from Ferrari, which was a curbside, and also the fully opening one. And we have had just recently a couple of times had somebody come along, and one of them was a really high-end car broker, and he said, look, I've brokered a deal between these two people. One of them's the owner at the moment, and he wants to keep the model, you know, but the new owner wants a model as well, so can I get, you know, and they ordered a replica of the model that we made a few years ago that went with the model, with the car in the first place. So yes, that does happen. And I also think there's a really good, you know, for sure having the model, it's like as time goes by and people are reselling these cars, that people, who, particularly when it's one of the Ferrari gift models that they've supplied to each customer, that it's kind of like having the original toolkit, you know, having the model.
I get that.
Deal in the first place, and you expect to have it there as well.
Yeah, I totally get that. Or the watch or whatever, like all of those things that you can now buy along with. If I found an Amalgam model that was like on eBay or something, or managed to procure one, could I send it back to you to be like touched up and then maybe the color change or something. Do you do those sorts of things?
We would definitely refurbish it, but a color change is really undesirable.
Okay.
From our point of view, it's because, you know, we assemble the model never in the expectation that it's going to be coming apart again.
Yeah.
And that if you then start to disassemble it, you know, you run into all kinds of problems with damage and so forth. Not impossible, but generally speaking, it would cost the same as having a new model made. So just have a new model. I mean, that sounds like a kind of sales pitch, but it isn't. It seriously is.
I know what you mean. If you've got to respray it, you've got to take a lot of it apart, which is a huge part of the whole thing. And then it's not designed to come apart. So I can see how it's, and I can see why you guys don't necessarily want to do that. You're like, we'd rather make fresh new ones. Thank you very much.
That's right. There is also, I mean, going back to my architectural model making days, is that inevitably, and kind of harking back to your question about, you know, traumatic events in the model making process, is that, you know, with architectural models, you're working through, you know, parallel to the design process. And quite often, you know, the architects would just get, you think that you're well on the way to getting this model finished, and suddenly they just realize that they just want to change something fundamental. And they say, yeah, well, can't you just sort of tear it down? And yeah, okay. And one of the things that we built a tremendous reputation on was the willingness to, you know, fully focused on the reason for making the model, as opposed to just loving this, owning it for ourselves. You know, it's a tool towards an objective. So we're always willing to make these kind of radical changes. But, you know, I would, when presented with the opportunity or the choice between reworking something and the feeling that it's not ever as kind of crisp and sharp and nice and, you know, and just tear it, throw it in the bin, start again. That's what I would always go for, the throw it in the bin, start again option.
Yeah, I get that. Totally.
To do that with old cars.
There are actually some hilariously insane videos on YouTube of people rebuilding like little die-cast models and stuff. Like I've definitely lost a few minutes of just watching this melted car come back to life and being like, yeah, that's pretty impressive. It's quite interesting how they do that. Right, well, I normally wrap this up with five questions. Okay. Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
That's a good one. That's an easy one. My immediately comes to mind is that in my youth, I remember how old I probably was at the time. I think I'd have been in my late teens. I was invited to go on a trip. I cannot remember why or where we were heading to, actually, but a London friend of mine, who was definitely right out on the edges of, in terms of alternative criminality. He had a Sunbeam Tiger.
Yeah.
Which back then was, I had no idea what a Sunbeam Tiger was, but we blasted up from London to Manchester, I think it was. But anyway, a long motorway trip. And, you know, he was just pushing it right to the limit, 150 miles an hour up the motorway. So this was definitely not the days, you know, if you think back to, you know, that's in the early 70s. Speed limits were absolutely in place, but then, you know, there wasn't a lot of technology, was there?
Yeah,
so if you were spotted by a jam sandwich, you know, looking past at 150 miles an hour, there wasn't a lot they could do about it, really. Phone ahead to the next town or whatever and sort of get somebody out, but they wouldn't bother. That was pretty memorable, especially as the it had some bearings that had failed on a lay shaft in the gearbox, which meant that when he was up at high speed, there was this shaft that was like thrashing around inside the gearbox. And he was piling up various pieces of apparel to kind of try and dampen the noise thus generated. And then on the way back, somebody in an E-Type kind of came alongside. Mm. And there was the look and the challenge, you know. We had a little race with that. That was great. So, I mean, I've had more exotic and faster car experiences than that now in the last few years with Ferrari hot laps and stuff. But that was
particularly
because of my youth.
Yeah, it sounds fun. I'm going to give you a car one. if you could only you get two cars, one is unlimited value, you have whatever you like, and one is £500.
Well, the unlimited value one, very, very difficult. Yeah, I think I'd probably take a 250 GTO.
Nice.
Which is rather tedious and boring of me. But, and the £500 car. Yeah, I don't know whether you've, well, £500, it wouldn't buy me a Lotus Super 7 these days, would it?
No, unfortunately not. This is a slightly...
What's he...
The question is, what costs £500? And the answer is, I genuinely haven't got a clue. The main reason this came about, and I need to do some more research on available options, was so that this one car, that you only had one car, is so you could have something slightly practical on the side, if you were happy to have a £500 practical car, so that you could have a sports car, and then it would...
The trouble with me is that my taste in modern cars is all... You know, not that they're outrageously. I've got an electric Audi e-tron.
Oh, nice!
Which is fantastic. Yeah. Really fantastic drive. I mean, honestly, it's so good. I love it so much. You know, it's quite exciting if you want it to be.
Yeah.
And so I don't have any ideas about sort of what's cheap to buy at £500 now. I mean, loads of you know, I drove a Lotus Cortina.
Mm.
So many decades ago that I thought was perhaps the best drive that I'd ever had up to that point. And I'm sure that I could have bought that for £500.
Yeah, back in the time. We'll go with that. Back in the day.
Yes.
What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? What do you think should be worth more?
Oh, there you've got me going. No, I can't help you with that. I really don't have the...
Model cars made by Amalgam.
Yeah, well, yes. No.
Okay.
Don't know.
Right.
I don't have an answer for that one.
Most interesting car. What are you Googling? What are you looking up?
Well, Valkyrie is quite interesting. It's a bit of a cheat because I'm looking at that at the moment because of our need to make models of it. Well, I do think that's I was talking to somebody about that earlier, is that it seems to be... the designers that I talk to from other companies all hugely admire Aston Martin's work on that car.
I think it's... ignoring whether it's finished and they're being delivered yet and all the stuff that's gone on in the middle, like, as a thing to, like, look at and to hear, it is unbelievable. Like, it's so cool. Whether it'll be an amazing road car, I have no idea. But it's a very cool thing. Right.
That's amazing company.
Final question. Five car garage. Unlimited value.
Okay. 57 SC Bugatti.
Nice. Yeah.
250 GTO.
Yeah.
250 Testarossa.
Going for some big hitters here.
That's three.
Do you have a daily? What's your daily in this
world? I think that a... Porsche 959.
Mm. Nice.
And going for the cheap end of the market, the Lotus Cortina that I just mentioned.
Cool.
Because it was such a fun car to drive.
I think that would do you nicely, that bunch. To have a pretty good garage.
Yes, I might swap out the Lotus Cortina for a one of the original Lotus Super 7s that I was
at the time. Yeah. Nice.
No, I think the Cortina's a little more, you know, you can actually take a passenger properly.
Put some stuff in the boot and all that. They look like fun when I see them racing. They're like all over the shop. They look good.
That's what I remember about the Lotus Cortina was the tremendous ability to just throw the tail around.
It just
is a beautiful responsiveness, very smooth power delivery.
Yeah, it looked good. Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Well, it's been a pleasure. More pleasurable than I thought it might be.
Oh, good.